Welcome. This is the Woodbury Church of Christ Sermon Podcast. We're glad that you tuned in, and if you'd like to know more about our church, you can find out all the information at woodburychurch.org. Or we'll see you some Sunday. Sundays at 10 a.m. Looking forward to it.
A couple things I wanted to just let you know about. One, I just cannot help but have this feeling. It's just been true all week. It's been true for a while, and it was true this morning, that I think God is really doing something special in our church, in our congregation. I think God has plans for us. I think he's got a purpose for us, plans for good, and I think that there's something exciting that is stirring in this church. And so I'm so glad to be a part of that. It's not like I get to tell God what to do, but I'm so grateful if God comes along and uses us. I just think that that's an amazing thing. You will never find greater purpose in your life than when you feel you are being used by God. You will never find any greater purpose in your life. The second thing I want to say is we have more people watching online than usual because this is 833 School District Spring Break. So they are watching from their iPads on the beach. I just wanted to tell you, I hope you don't get too much sand in your iPad. It must be really tough, but we're glad that you're watching online as well. I just wanted to start off framing what we're going to be talking about with this experience that I think is common. Certainly, I've felt it before. I think you have as well. But it's this thing where you are trying to do the right thing. You're trying to listen for the voice of God. You're trying to be obedient. You're trying to follow what you think God is doing and where you think God is taking you. You're staying up to date on our reading plan as a church. But the more you do, the more it doesn't feel like you're headed where you want to go. The more you feel like, this is not how I thought my life was going to be. This is not how I felt I thought I would feel at this point in my life and my choices and my career. And it just doesn't feel like these choices to follow God are moving me closer to what I want out of life. You know, it's like being a passenger with a driver that you're not confident they know where they're going. Or being in the back seat of an Uber and you're like, I don't think this is the way to the airport. And you pull out your phone and you double check, are they really taking me where I want to go? There is a correlation to that with our relationship with God, where, God, I'm doing what I thought you were asking me to do, and it doesn't look like we're going the right direction. It doesn't look like we're headed to the airport, God. Are you sure you're in control of this vehicle? God will lead you through the wilderness for your own good. That's all I have to say to you this morning. Seriously, I'm just going to say that about five more times. I'm going to tell some stories and show you some other scripture in between, but that's really all there is. And that's one of those truths that, you know, you hear that and you're like, oh, yeah, okay. But I hope by the time that we're done talking today, that's one of those truths that will feel like it just resonates with your experience and your life, and that because that is true, you will be able to just express deep trust in God. God will lead you through the wilderness for your own good. We, as a church family, have been working through a journey of the Torah. We called it Torah Together. The Torah is the first five books of the Hebrew Bible, of the Old Testament, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, all the exciting books that everybody loves to read, especially when it gets into the tedious laws and genealogies, right? That's everybody's favorite part. Some of you, if you're a little behind, that's fine. You'll catch up, and some of what I'm talking about today will resonate. If this is your first Sunday, and you're like, I'm totally out of it, believe me, the truths that we have to learn today out of the book that we're going to be studying or we're going to be doing an overview, they're going to resonate whether or not you've read it. And I just want you to feel good about being along on this journey with us. So we have, if you're current, which I know some of you are, few of you are, if you're current, we have just finished the book of Numbers. You've read through the book of Numbers. Yeah, a lot of blank stares. That's kind of what I assumed. You're like, Numbers. It's a great book, kind of a terrible title. Like if God had said, Patrick, what do you think about, we're going to market this book of Numbers and we're going to call it Numbers, I would have said, can you call it anything else? Math is not in anything I'm interested in. Counting is not anything I'm interested in. Numbers doesn't make any sense. It feels like, in fact, you start off and you end the book of Numbers with chapter after chapter of Excel spreadsheet data, about how many people were in each given Hebrew tribe. And you're just like, what is this about? Why is this in the Bible? Why is this recorded for time immemorial for us to study and read? Why is that? And some of you skipped through those parts. You got into these sections where it was like, oh, there were 75,297 people in the tribe of Gad. I'm just skipping all that. Let's just jump to some story. How many of you skipped it? Just kidding. Don't raise your hand. Almost got you. Some of you are like, I'm in church. Got to tell the truth. I have come to think that maybe Numbers is the perfect name for this book, and that it's an inspiring name, and I have come to believe that the data, the literal numbers, in the book of Numbers is crucial. It is crucial to our faith, and it can have a tremendous effect on your faith today, and I'll tell you why later. I've heard lots of people say some version of, I don't really get into the Old Testament, I just stick with Jesus. Now, we're doing this Torah together for a reason, and it's not so you can win trivia night at church, although that would be fun. That would be a cool thing to do. It's because this is something that's incredible. In fact, you could even just do this afternoon, and I suppose if you get incredibly bored, you could do it right now. But if you go to almost any place in the New Testament and you start reading, you're going to notice things that are from the Hebrew Bible, that are from the Old Testament. It's going to give life and depth to what you are reading about the story of Jesus to have read the scriptures that shaped Jesus. It's tremendously valuable. Let me give you just one small example of this. You remember that story in Numbers? It's super weird. The people complain again. The Hebrew people complain again. God has provided for them time after time after time. They complain again. And then there's these snakes that come from wherever, right? You remember the story? And they're like, oh, we're really sorry about complaining. And God says, okay, Moses, make a bronze snake and then raise it up in the air, and everybody who looks at the snake will be healed. You read that story and you're like, what is that about? What is going on there? And how long did that take? You got these snakes, the snake infestation of the camp, and Moses has to smelt some bronze and form it into a snake. And I don't know how long this all took. But I do think that if this story, if you're thinking through the details of this story, and you're, I would not be looking up like Indiana Jones style when he goes into that one place where all the snakes, I would not, if somebody said, take your eyes off the ground and look up in the sky at this bronze snake in the air, I'd be like, no, thank you. I'm going to watch out for the danger on the ground. And so you can imagine how this story would play out. Now, but what is the point of it? What's the point of this strange little story tucked in the book of Numbers chapter 21? Jesus later comes along, John 3, 14, and 15. This is right before we get to the famous John 3, 16, although it's listed incorrectly up there. That's my bad. Just as Moses lifted up the snake in the wilderness, so the Son of Man, Jesus, must be lifted up that everyone who believes may have eternal life in him. So Jesus saw that story, and he said, you guys know that story? That story applies to me. That story is about me. I have to be lifted up from the earth, and everybody that looks at me will be saved. Everybody who takes their eyes off the misery and the brokenness in the world that looks at me will be saved. Paul later comes along in 1 Corinthians 10:19. Remember, these stories shaped them. Paul comes along later in 1 Corinthians 10:19, and he says, we should not test Christ, as some of them did, and were killed by snakes. Now, there's something funny about that way Paul read that. We should not test who? Well, where? How? I don't remember reading about Jesus in that story, and Paul says, yeah, Jesus was in that story. You were testing Christ when you did that in the wilderness. Now, there's so many things we could talk about, but it's super cool to understand that this short, strange little story gives depth and color to the New Testament, and your understanding of Jesus will be deepened by your willingness to wade into the world of the Hebrew Bible and understand that it shaped Jesus, it shaped the authors of Scripture. It's pretty cool. God will lead you through the wilderness for your good. The wilderness. Several years ago, my daughter and I, we've done this thing where we've agreed to take them on some trip when they turn 13 years old, and we get to let them pick where. We're hoping that their imagination doesn't get too big and they just pick somewhere within the continental United States that's cheap to get to. But my oldest daughter, when she turned 13, she said she wanted to go to New York City. So we had this little weekend trip. It was just me and her because I like doing that kind of stuff. And we flew from Minneapolis to Chicago O'Hare. And I don't remember the circumstances, but there was some sort of mass cancellation of flights. Not just like one flight, or not just that they had overbooked and they were looking for people to give up seats, but like this mass cancellation, all kinds of flights. Because normally when they cancel a flight, they say, oh, huh, that's really too bad. Here's a hotel voucher and some, you know, some money for food. You know, sorry about that. We'll get you on the next flight out. They didn't do any of that. I don't even remember which airlines it was. They didn't do any of that. They just said, you're out of luck. We can get you on a flight tomorrow. And this is like, you know, at this point, it's probably 12 hours later. So we didn't know what to do. No hotel voucher, no nothing. We're just wandering around trying to keep this trip on a budget. And about midnight, the employees at Chicago O'Hare started rolling out cots for these hundreds of passengers that were stranded in whatever it was, Terminal 3 at O'Hare. Just these cots. And it looked something like this. This isn't exactly where we were, but it was these kind of cots. Like there was some sort of natural disaster and that, you know, this was FEMA coming in to help us out. And they said, hey, if you need to take a rest, here you go. How well are you going to relax and sleep in a fully lit terminal around hundreds of strangers? Not well. It's not very relaxing at all. I mean, we paid good money to be in New York City, and here we are on a cot in Chicago O'Hare. It was not good. It's uncomfortable. It's a little scary. You're restless. You kind of fitfully lay there for a few hours while people cough and make all kinds of weird noises, but you're stuck. You can't go back to where you were. You can't sleep in your own bed, and you can't get to where you're going. You're just totally stuck. You're in between. There's a spiritual counterpart to that sense of stuckness, that sense of in-betweenness. The Bible talks about over and over again. Social psychologists call it liminal space, where you're not where you were and you're not where you're going. You're in between. Pixar famously used it as a formula in their hit movies, and I feel like Pixar's gotten a little weird the last few years, but early on they had this formula they called Act 2, and that's where the formation of the hero happened. That's where Marlin leaves the safety of the reef to find Nemo. That's where Woody has to leave the safety of Andy's bedroom with Buzz to get where they need to go. It's the Act 2, it's the in-between, it's the liminal space. The Bible calls it the wilderness. The wilderness. God will lead you through the wilderness for your own good. The book of Numbers is all about the wilderness. They're between Egypt and Canaan. They're between slavery and settlement. They're between past and promise and rescue and rest. It's why last week, Steve, who's on a road trip right now, by the way, he's coming back. In fact, my guess is Steve and Tina are probably listening, or hopefully listening, not watching, on I-35. I guess they're in Nashville, but whatever road they're on, I'm guessing they're watching right now. Steve, I hope you're not watching. I hope you're listening. But Steve talked about a road trip that the Hebrew people were on. And then remember, he gave two examples of being on a road trip, and both of them were like the worst road trip ever. After church, somebody said, hey, remind me never to go anywhere with Steve, because it sounds awful. So the people of Israel, they pull up the tent pegs on their tents and the tabernacle. God told them exactly how to pack everything up and what order to go in, and they begin this road trip. It's like when mom, if you've done this, mom and dad, you know, you buckle the kids into their seat, you make sure everybody's tucked in where they're supposed to go, you got the bag of snacks, you got the rear view mirror adjusted just like you want it to be, and then as you're backing out the driveway, the kids start complaining, and you're like, this is going to be a long trip. That's exactly what's happening in the book of Numbers. Numbers 10:23, so they set out from the mountain of the Lord. This is where they had been for a year. This is where the Ten Commandments, this is where Charlton Heston got, you know, all that exciting stuff, and Cecil B. DeMille's Ten Commandments, all this stuff happened at Mount Sinai. For a year they were there. They're at the base of the mountain, and they picked up the tents, and they moved. They set out from the mountain of the Lord, and they traveled for just 3 days. The Ark of the Covenant of the Lord went before them during those 3 days to find them a place to rest. And the book of Numbers is all about this question: how are the people of God going to handle the in-between? Are they going to trust in God? Are they going to rely on God? Or are they going to freak out? That's the question presented in the book of Numbers. Are they going to rely on God or are they going to freak out? Now, some of you have read the book of Numbers. What happens? Immediate freak out. Immediately. I'm immediately going to do the thing God doesn't want me to do. I'm immediately going to complain. And some of you got a little annoyed with the Hebrew people as you were reading through this. You're like, this is a little ridiculous. I mean, I sometimes whine about things, but these guys are bad. And I want you to hold off judgment just for a second with them. What we learn is in the very next verse, they set out from the mountain of the Lord. And just as Dad puts the car in reverse and backs out the driveway, Numbers 11:1. Now the people complained about their hardships in the hearing of the Lord. And when he heard them, his anger was aroused. And then a few verses later, they complain about the food. And then a chapter later, Moses' brother and sister complain about like how Moses gets all the attention. Why is Moses so special? And then later, they complain when God gives them a little sneak peek of the promised land and how awesome it is. They start to get worried about the people that occupy the promised land. And they say, we can't take on those people. God has led us out here in the wilderness to die. And they say, no thanks. And they actually want to kill Moses. They say, no, thank you. We don't want to go into the promised land. And you know what God does? God says, okay, your whole generation is going to hang out and you're going to die here in the wilderness because you didn't want to go to where I was leading you. And they're always hungry and they're always thirsty. It just feels like a road trip with kids. It constantly feels like that. I had several people this week tell me, like, it's just so annoying. These people are so annoying. Now, when you first hear them whine and then they get struck by a plague, you're like, that's a little harsh, God. They're complaining, and then God says, you know, we're going to strike you with disease or whatever. But by the 10th time they do it, you're kind of like, I get it. I wish God would have struck them a little bit more. But can I offer a defense for the complaining? Just a defense. I know, not that I'm trying to encourage you to complain, because some of you do a great job of that already. That's one of your gifts. But let me offer a defense, because I'm not saying it was good. I'm saying I get it. I get it. They're in between. They had been told by Moses, who said he had spoken to Yahweh, that they would leave slavery in Egypt and they would be taken into a promised land, and they're in the middle of nowhere. Nothing is happening. Nothing is changing. And you can kind of understand, give up your familiar lives. Give up the thing that maybe was harsh, but at least you knew what was coming the next day. Follow God and I will bless you. Now they're miles deep in the wilderness. They're eating the same food for every meal, facing this uncertain future. Listen to how they articulate one of the complaints in Numbers 16:14. You, Moses, you haven't brought us into a land flowing with milk and honey. Or given us an inheritance of fields and vineyards. You haven't given us what you promised. What are they saying? We're stuck. We're feeling in between, and it doesn't feel like there's a future. It doesn't feel like there's a hope. It doesn't feel like anything's going to change or anything's going to happen. Moses, you told us there would be snacks, and there's no snacks. You told us you were going to stop for bathroom breaks every 90 minutes, and there's been no bathroom breaks. They're in the wilderness. And I get it. I get the complaining because we have done the exact same thing. We have done the exact same thing. God will lead you through the wilderness for your own good, but we're in the wilderness and we're like, God, I don't like this at all. I don't want this. In fact, I don't know that I trust that you have the GPS set in the right direction, so I think I'm going to have to make my own decisions now. I'm going to have to take control of the wheel. Instead of Jesus take the wheel, it's me take the wheel. We've done the exact same thing. Now, it's not just me. It's not just me who's trying to make a metaphor of the wilderness. The New Testament authors of Scripture did the same thing. As they read these stories, they said, these stories exemplify life with God, even in the New Testament. 1 Corinthians 10:6, now these things, the Torah, the wilderness wanderings, these things occurred as examples to keep us from setting our hearts on evil things as they did. Or Hebrews 3:8, do not harden your hearts as you did in the rebellion during the time of testing in the wilderness. God leads you through the wilderness for your good. Do not harden your hearts. Now, our lives are full of wilderness moments. I can't even begin to guess what yours are, but let me give you some examples that may be relatable. It's any time, any significant moment when the outcome of a situation is uncertain and out of your control. That's the wilderness. When the outcome is uncertain and out of your control. So anytime you're losing, leaving, or looking for a job, that is a form of wilderness. God, where am I going here? What's happening next? Anytime a loved one is in the hospital and you don't know what the diagnosis is or you don't know what the prognosis will be, that's the wilderness. Middle school. Moving from home to college. Living at college can feel like the wilderness. Like, I don't know what's next. I don't know if I'm going to get a job. I don't know if there's going to be a career path for me. I don't know. It feels like the wilderness. Retirement can feel like the wilderness. The end of a relationship can feel like the wilderness. Every single stage of parenting feels like the wilderness. Every single one. Any health diagnosis, the outcome is uncertain, and I'm not in control. A mental illness, a prodigal son or daughter, it's all wilderness moments where the outcome is uncertain, and we are not in control, and we want to pull every lever and push every button to make what we want to happen happen, and there just isn't anything that we can do. So, in other words, what I'm saying is the wilderness is pretty much life. Have you noticed that? It's pretty much life. When the outcome is uncertain and you're not as much control as you think you are. In March of 2020, it seems like something significant happened. I had just started this sermon series and I called it The Illusion of Control. The Illusion of Control. I had no idea. Coronavirus, COVID-19, no clue. And I just think back on that moment. And God was giving me a little something because we had no idea what was coming. Life, we had the illusion of control, and then that illusion was ripped away from us. Now, the author of Hebrews says the same thing too. And you'll notice the author of Hebrews, it's the reason it's called Hebrews, because it's written about these stories to Hebrew-thinking people. So the author of Hebrews does an excellent job of helping us understand the Old Testament stories, the Torah. But Hebrews 3:16 says, who were they who heard and rebelled? Were they not all that Moses led out of Egypt? And with whom was God, was he angry for 40 years? So he says this, so we see that they were not able to enter that rest because of their unbelief. Therefore, since the promise of entering his rest still stands for us, since the promise of entering rest still stands for us, what does that mean? It means we are in the wilderness. Let us be careful that none of you be found have fallen short of it. So the question for us in the wilderness spaces, whatever it is for you, the beginning of a career, the end of one, the beginning of a relationship, the end of one, whatever it is for you, are you going to rely on God or are you going to freak out? And let me tell you something. I have tried the freak out option hundreds of times. And not once has it worked well for me. But you know what's going to happen? The next time I'm in that sort of dilemma and I'm going, do I trust God or freak out? I'm going to be tempted to freak out again. And you know how well it's going to work for me? Not at all. You've been there too. You've done it too. Oh yeah, let's just freak out about this. That'll give me some sense that I have control. At least I'm freaking out if not doing anything else. Is it going to solve any problems? No. Is it going to make things worse? Very likely. The wilderness is always, always, always uncomfortable, it's always dangerous, and it's always necessary. The wilderness is uncomfortable, it's dangerous, and necessary. I went skiing for the first time a week ago Friday, and I got to join my son as part of their ski club, and it was his first time skiing too. So we had made this plan. Now, full disclosure, I had skied once maybe 10, 15 years ago, and it was a disaster. There's a term for how skiing went for me. It's called a yard sale, and that's when you are down the hill and your boots and skis and helmets and gloves are just spread across the lawn as if it's a garage sale you're having. So that's how it went for me the first time. Went down a hill a couple times, then turned everything in and said, never doing that again. But Liam, My 11-year-old wanted to ski. We had watched some guys on the terrain park the week before. We'd been snowboarding. And so we thought, yes, we can do this. So I said, we have to have a plan. So step one, let's watch some YouTube videos. So we did. Watched a couple YouTube videos. I think we've got it, buddy. I think we've got the technique. But step two, we're going to go out to the mountain, the bluff. We're going to go out to Afton, and we're going to do not the bunny hill. The bunny hill's a little too much for us. We're going to do the baby bunny hill. You know what the baby bunny hill is? They got this thing. It's pretty cool. It's called a magic carpet. You don't even have to ride a lift. You just stand there, and the magic carpet is like it's like an escalator without stairs, and it just pulls you up to the top. And it's a slope. You know, it's a tiny little slope, and it's about, it's not very long. So I said, we're going to do that, and we'll probably just spend all day there. So he said, sure, that sounds good. So we got our boots on and, you know, felt pretty good, strapped those boots on really tight, went out to the hill, got on the magic carpet. There was this gentleman who was at the top of the magic carpet, and he's there to press the stop button in case there's a disaster, which is very important. And he could tell, I'm sure, just looking at us move in our skis and our boots, that we were first-timers. And so we got up to the top, and he's like, have you done this before? And I said, No, this is our first time. He said, well, let me give you some pointers. And he was great, super helpful. He's just the attendant. Nobody else is there. So he gives us these really helpful things. Here's all the do's and don'ts. Here's what you want to do. So we go down the hill the first time. No accidents. Feeling a little confident. Like, I think I got this. I think I can do this. We went back up the baby bunny hill. He gave us a few more pointers. But I'm kind of thinking, I got this. The second time down, I did a slow motion crash right into my son. I mean, the harder I tried not to, the more I was like, and we both went down. Now, you are probably experts. It is impossible to get up with skis on. I'm sure it feels like what a baby deer looks like as it's beginning its first steps. And I'm just like, I'm pulling muscles and everything. I'm just like, this is awful. And the attendant at the top, there's nobody else, so he's just watching us the whole time. And he stops the thing, and he walks down to us, and he's like, yep, there's no easy way to do it. And I'm like, well, thank you. That's very helpful. I appreciate that. And he gives me a couple more pointers. And then on our third trip up, he says this to me, and I don't know that I'll ever forget this. We ride up the thing again, and he literally tells me these words. He just looks at me, and he says, good for you for trying something at your age. The helmet, it puts on wrinkles, I'm sure. A very young man, sir. The in-between from strapping those ski boots on and confidently going down the hill, it's pretty uncomfortable. And it took a while. That was pretty uncomfortable. And I had to talk certain family members that were with me out of giving up every few seconds because it's hard. It's hard. It's hard. The in-between is hard. It's uncomfortable. Leaving the financial security of one job because it takes you away from your family without being certain of your financial future, that's uncomfortable. Leaving the relational security of an unhealthy relationship, but knowing that it's not good for you, but not sure what is out there for you, that's uncomfortable. Changing your college major because you're convicted by God that God has something different for you, that's uncomfortable, that's uncertain. Giving up on any dream because you're convicted that it's not God's plan is uncomfortable. And we so long for certainty as humans that we're willing to make dangerous and deadly decisions in the wilderness. Dangerous decisions. We return to bad but comfortable habits. We try to find shortcuts. When we don't know what to do, we kind of resort to our worst selves. Look at what happens in Numbers chapter 11, verse 4. It says, the rabble with them begin to crave other food. God had provided food. They just didn't want that food. And again, the Israelites started wailing. If we only had meat to eat. We remember the fish we ate in Egypt at no cost. It just jumped out of the sea onto our plates fully cooked. Also the cucumbers and the melons and the leeks and the onions and the garlics. But now we have lost our appetite. We never see anything but this manna. Oh, the old ways, man. Sure, there were some bad parts about it, but it wasn't all bad. No. Every single one of their complaints was some version of true. But they left out huge pieces of data. Sure, we were slaves. Sure, we had a genocidal dictator. Sure, we were constantly miserable, but we had onions. But that's the problem with being in between and being in the wilderness, is that's how we feel, like we long for those old days because there was certainty. And they were saying, I am willing to trade a future with God for slavery just so I can feel certain about what tomorrow brings. What a dangerous way to live. It's dangerous, but it's also necessary. It's also necessary. Carmen Imes is an Old Testament theologian, and she was speaking about the book of Exodus, but she said something that really struck me about the wilderness, and I love this. But she said, God had gotten his people out of Egypt. Now he had to get Egypt out of his people. The old ways, the old values, the old culture, the old thinking, that had to be purged. Which is why James says in James chapter 1, he says, you should consider it pure joy when you go through trials, when you go through the wilderness, because God is transforming you. He's developing perseverance in you. You're being purged from those old ways. Hebrews, again, chapter 12 says, the discipline of God in the wilderness refines us, because God will lead you through the wilderness for your own good. So how can we be certain, though? Because if you're right in the middle of something, you're like, I don't know. How can I be sure that there is a certain future on the other end of this? How can I be sure that God will keep his promises? Because that's what the Hebrew people were wrestling with. They had been promised something. God had shown up again and again and again. But they're like, but how do I know that this time God will show up? How do I know that this time God will be on my side? The book of Numbers starts and ends with census data. Literally. Numbers. That's how it starts, chapter after chapter after chapter, and you're just like, I do not care how many people the Naphtalites had in their tribe. This is just doesn't matter, right? And you're like, skim, 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 skim. And then you got to the end of the book of Numbers, and guess what happens at the end? More data. And I don't know anybody do this. I actually totaled it up between the two to see if had they grown, had they lost. There was a lot of plagues and snakes biting people, and it's actually a smaller group at the end, which is kind of fascinating, but beside the point. So we're told the exact size of each tribe, and we're told there's about 600,000 fighting-age men in between these two tribes. So it's kind of roughly a little bigger than the populations of St. Paul and Minneapolis, just in fighting-age men. So, you know, if you run it through some sort of algorithm and you account for kids and the elderly and all the spouses and everybody, you have what some scholars estimate to be about 2 million people. 2 million people in this crowd. That's a lot of people. It's the size of the city of Chicago, just about. Just the city. Have you ever had your kids do this to you, where you're at the store and they, you know, you try not to take them down the toy aisle because it's just a disaster. And you happen to go by it anyway, and they run down the toy aisle, and they're like, bring you back some ridiculously overpriced thing, and they're like, will you buy this for me? And you say, no, absolutely not. I will not buy that for you. It's ridiculous. Your birthday's, you know, 6 months away. No, we're not going to buy it. Have you ever had a kid say something like this, pull something like this? You never buy me anything. You ever had that? You never buy me anything. As they are wearing clothes, walking in shoes, riding in cars, playing on iPads, maybe listening to AirPods that you bought them. You have provided for them every step of the way, and just because they can't have this ridiculous Star Wars Lego set, oh, you never buy me anything. Imagine these Hebrew people. Oh, we just want to go back to Egypt. We just want some leeks and some onions and some garlic. That would be so good. God, you never give us anything good. And God's like, oh, yeah? Oh, yeah? What about every step of the way? We're in a desert, and you've had plenty of water to drink every step of the way. You've had food you could gather every morning. But here's the thing that I think is really cool. Let's think about those numbers, this nation. Way back, you may recall this, way back in Genesis chapter 12, God had promised that Abram, later Abraham, would be the father of many people, of many nations. And in fact, God escorted Abram out into the wilderness and told him to look up at the sky and said, can you count those stars? That's how many kids you're going to have. it will be innumerable. It will be beyond counting. And so I think, this is what I believe to be true, is that every time the Hebrew people opened up their tent flap and looked out at the 2 million people that were surrounding them, they were reminded that God was a God who kept his promise for generations and for centuries. Every time they gathered up their tents and 2 million people raised a cloud of dust as they walked from one stop to the other, they should have been reminded that this is a God. He is literally keeping his promises. We can open our eyes and we can look at our friends and our neighbors and our family as evidence of God's promises being kept. Is God going to keep his promises? He has given us overwhelming and abundant evidence. We literally sometimes just have to open our eyes. Because when we complain, we tend to focus on that one thing. But if we would open our eyes to what God has done in our lives, I think the evidence would be overwhelming. There are literal numbers as evidence of a promise being kept. God's saying, I'm not going to miss a single person. I'm going to keep my promises down to the decimal point. That's good news for us. That's why we shouldn't skip the data. That's why we shouldn't skip the numbers. So next time you're in the wilderness and you're starting to panic, God, why did you bring me here? God, what are you doing? God, why don't I have the one? Why don't I have the job? Why don't I have the house? Why am I in between? Why don't I have onions and garlic, God? Just remember, God will lead you through the wilderness for your good. We're going to stand together and we're going to sing. I'm going to invite the praise team back up. We're going to sing and we're going to acknowledge that we come broken to a God. We come as people who continue to complain despite promises kept. We come as people who forget, who mess up, who get it wrong. Go ahead and stand. Who don't understand, who struggle when we're in that choice between do I rely on God or do I freak out? We got to remember that God has always kept his promises and he always will from the earliest days of Scripture. Let's sing this together.